Sloppy Spoilers with your host, DT2. Hello and welcome to Sloppy Spoilers. I'm your host, David Taylor II. You know me as DT2 Comics Chat on Twitter. I'd like to welcome my co-host. Welcome to David Nemesis Howard. What's up, Dave?
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Really looking forward to talking this series. We talked the first season, and this second season, I was impressed. So I am looking forward to talking about this.
Where can we find you on Twitter?
Oh, sorry. You can find me at NemesisFC2, at NemesisFC2, Sunday Beer League Football for everybody.
And I'd like to welcome Steve Shadewing Sellers. What's up, Steve?
Oh, doing all right. And I'm glad to finally get into a show that we actually like for once. And not only that, a show that actually offers us hope in these dark times. And I think we all need that right now. And you can find me over at Shadewing. It's spelled pretty much the way it sounds.
All right, folks, we're going to be talking about The Mandalorian Season 2. In this pod, we're going to do episodes 1 and 2. We're going to take a little break after the first episode, and we're also going to do episode 2 as well. Now, the first episode is entitled The Marshal. And at first glance, you might miss a lot of things. There's Easter eggs, but it's very, very layered. There are a lot of good things going on. So I'll just give a quick recap, and then I'm going to ask my co-host for overall thoughts. This episode pretty much picks up from where we left off with the last season, remembering, of course, that Mando and the child don't know that Moff Gideon survived. He cuts his way out of the TIE fighter with the Darksaber. We see that. The audience knows that. They don't know that yet. But Mando's got a new quest. He's got to get the child back to the Jedi. So that setup alone shows you it's going to be a season full of adventure. The Marshal is basically rooted in a Western. It's also rooted in a bunch of Beowulf tropes, because basically a guy comes in from out of town that helps him defeat a monster. And so Mando goes looking for where he might find other Mandalorians, because they would have connections to find other Jedi. So, of course, that leads him to Tatooine, because of course it does, because why we have to just live on Tatooine? Of course we do. So Mando meets Pelimoto, Amy Sedaris, which is the Mandalorian's version of Ripley. And there's also an Easter egg for R4, which was the droid Luke would have picked if he hadn't picked R5-D4, mm-hmm. because the droid, you know, popped a gasket or something, so he picked R2. But R5 is there with Peli. And long story short, we're dealing with the Tusken Raiders, the Sand People. Sand People using it, being used in a pejorative term. How the Marshal, played by Timothy Olyphant, has brought order to the town. But now they've got almost a medieval problem. They have a dragon, a crate dragon. I didn't, wasn't sure about the spelling. It's K-R-A-Y-T. Krayt dragons have also appeared in Star Wars Episode 4. There's a skeleton there, so they're not new to the mythos. So once again, moving into general comments on my part, I just love when show writers love and know the lore. I just love when they know and respect the mythology. Again, so many Easter eggs, so many tie-ins to the larger Star Wars world. And so I loved it. I loved everything I saw. It was a little bit cheesy at points. It felt a little bit like parody with them kind of squaring off on each other. But that's kind of the cheesiness of Westerns. So we'll have to go with that. Also, just to dip a little further as the season goes on, they finally demonstrate on a deeper level the toughness of Beskar armor. And I must say that we never got that impression from Boba Fett. Boba Fett was taken out so easily and so quickly. We had no idea what true Beskar armor could do, but they fixed that this season on this show. It's just incredible. So my overall thoughts, again, I loved it. I loved all the winks. I loved the way they developed the story. I love, once again, them showing Mando just be competent. Just be a competent protagonist that knows his strengths and his abilities, what he can do, how to get in and out of situations. They've even beefed up Baby Yoda's little hiding carriage. So where's got armor on it now? So when things go south, when things get hot, he knows how to hide like a turtle. So I really, really liked it. So let me hear from you guys. Let's hear your opening thoughts. Start with Dave.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'd say that if you really wanted to subtitle this entire season, it would be The Resurrection of Boba Fett's Legacy. I mean, that's basically what it is. You know, that's, you know, sloppy spoilers there for everybody as we go through this season. And I was all for it because really, let's be honest with ourselves, up until fairly recently, Boba Fett was kind of the running joke of the Star Wars universe, unfortunately. Especially because we, when first all saw him in Empire, we thought he was badass. And then, in my opinion, he was ruined in Jedi for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I agree with you about all the little things. The Krayt Dragon is really cool. It's the first time we've ever seen a live one, you know, in live action. The only other time I remember seeing them is in the Knights of the Old Republic game, and they really didn't do them justice. They were this small thing. Maybe they were supposed to be baby Krayt Dragons or something. I don't know. But I do remember that huge skeleton in the very first, in A New Hope, you know, when C-3PO and R2 are walking across the desert, you know, and you're always like, what in the world is that? And then here, Filoni and Favreau bring it to life for us. And it was one of those special moments that you had throughout this entire episode through the series of these guys get it. You know, these guys are tuned in to the things that would make Star Wars fans happy. Another one for me, you know, and I'm just going to leave it at this as my general thoughts. There's actually two. So the next one was the fact that they gave us a new town. What was the mining town, Mos Pelgo, but they kept the naming convention, which is so important for Tatooine because all of these settlements are Mos Eisley, Mos, you know, I forget the other names, but they're, you know, that is the naming convention of this planet. And so they kept that Mos Pelgo. It seems like a little thing, but if they hadn't done that, if they had called it something completely different, it would have stuck in our minds because we know that that is how towns are named on the planet of Tatooine or settlements. And then the last thing on the Western, I really appreciate it. It really felt fun. I love the guy who played, was it Vanth? You said that was Timothy Oliphant, I believe. Mm-hmm. I love that character. And to me, the whole vibe of this whole episode reminded me of the Man with No Name movies with Clint Eastwood. You know, I thought I was watching, you know, Star Wars take on A Fistful of Dollars. That's really what it felt like.
Yes. When I hear the name Vanth, I think of Dreadstar, but that's another conversation. Mm-hmm. Okay. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was thinking Vanth Dreadstar, too. But yeah, as far as this episode goes, yeah, they pretty much nailed just about everything in this respect. I do also love the way that they got the lore intact. I'm a huge fan of Knights of the Old Republic, like huge. The second game is one of my favorite Star Wars games ever. So it was just really great to see the Krayt Dragon come in. And not only that, I was watching playthroughs of KOTOR 1 where they run into the dragon. And it just kind of made me realize like how on the ball they were to that version. They remembered that the hide of the Krayt Dragon is blaster proof. They actually kept the bit of, well, you have to get it through the belly and use mines. The thing is, they actually twisted it in this episode by having that not quite work, which I really love. Like, you know, so those that actually played the game and knew what to expect were watching this and realized, oh my God, they're subverting our expectations, but they're doing it well. So, you know, that's the kind of, when we talk about subverting expectations and where it goes right and wrong, We like seeing it here because it actually increases tension and makes sense for the characters. It's not just, you know, doing weird things just to do them. And that really, like, worked with that. The whole Western angle, I think, is so key to the core mythology of Star Wars. And the whole idea is that in many ways, Star Wars is a space Western. It's mixed with a lot of other things. But a lot of the influences are Westerns, and also samurai movies like The Hidden Fortress. So when I look at how Mando is approached in the show, it's very much Lone Wolf and Cub by way of Cowboy Bebop. And so we get to see that in here in this episode. When we're dealing with, you know, typical tropes like, okay, you know, we got the marshal and he doesn't quite trust the stranger and the stranger has to prove himself. And, you know, all of these things that we've seen 100 times before, but it has this bright, shiny new coat of paint. And it's fun to see Mando go through those paces with Baby Yoda, you know, as he goes through this adventure. And so, yeah, as a Star Wars fan, I'm really happy. As somebody who loves the lore and the classic legend stuff, I was really happy with all that. And I really just enjoy the entire concept and how it embraces not just the Star Wars mythology, but also the mythology that Lucas himself drew on. And it really seems like Filoni and Favreau are making a show in the classic tradition, the way that George would have made it. And I think they've been good guardians of his legacy, especially in this show.
Now, those of you that are new to the podcast, we use a phrase called writer's code. When we talk about writer's code, we're talking about stepping back in the episodes and looking at them from a writer's point of view, what we think was well, what we think was done poorly, and how we do it differently. So Steve's dip into subverting expectations is an example of how we use writer's code. And I agree completely with what he's saying. That is the way to pleasantly surprise your audience and yet still honor the lore and the mythology. The thing that breeds divisiveness is when you trash the mythology and or the fans, that's the difference. So if you want to be the kind of writer that pleasantly surprises your audience, take what's already there in the story world and give it a twist that's in line with what has been established and doesn't trash anything that's existed before. And if you want to be subversive, divisive, then do things like make up powers we've never seen, let characters do things that are completely out of character, and reverse the trajectory of the lore that we've been enjoying for however many years. That's the difference. Go ahead, Dave. You want to say something?
No, I was just going to, you know, reiterate that to me what's most impressive, and Steve hit on it as well, is the Knights of the Old Republic game. It's obvious that the people who are doing the show, that are writing the show, have enjoyed everything that we as fans at large have enjoyed for decades. And that love comes through all the time. So even when they do make mistakes, they're mistakes of love, and it's easy to forgive. It's easier to forgive those than when somebody is telling you, I have no respect for everything that came before and I'm just going to change it.
That's right. Now, I'm going to jump in here with something maybe unexpected, but I'm really anxious to hear you guys' feedback on it. I want to talk briefly about, how can I say this, the social construction of this episode in terms of all the different factions represented. Because I think it's something underlying and maybe understated, but I want to hear how other people read it. This is what I mean. How are the Jawas portrayed? Are they wild cards? Are they morally gray? What about the Tusken Raiders, a.k.a. the Sand People? What about the townspeople? What about the Mandalorians? How are we viewing these different races, these different classes, and these different cultures? Because in this episode, they have to work together to survive. But the episode makes it clear that there's nothing but tension and mistrust, because the Tusken Raiders, a.k.a. the Sand People, and they use the Sand People as a pejorative. So it's definitely a racial slur in this context, the way they use it. They have to work together to survive, but the Sand People are also a threat to the townspeople, and so is the mining collective, because it's a very good mythological setup that when the empire collapses, there's going to be smaller factions, almost like mafias or little individual gangs. They're going to try to take over territory that the empire once held. All of that is present in this episode. That's why it's so well done. But I want to hear what you guys think about the social political structuring of how these different classes of people are presented. Do you like it? Do you not like it? Do you think it doesn't matter? Do you think it could be more of something, less of something? Let me hear your thoughts about that. Start with Steve.
Yeah, I generally do like what I've seen. The only thing I would say is that it's kind of a shame that we don't get to see more after Mando leaves, because everything is focused on Mando's relationship with these people during the course of the story. But at the same time, you're sort of wanting to see, yeah, but what happens next? You know, do the Tusken Raiders keep their word not to go after the townspeople again? Do the townspeople maybe provoke another conflict later on? You know, what is the mining guild, you know, getting involved in after that? You know, so, yeah, I would say I love the world building, and I love how they think of the consequences of what would the galaxy be like without the Empire there? What is the Empire preventing from happening? Likewise, you know, what happens, with the factions of the Empire now that the Emperor is no longer in control? Because I'm kind of like keeping aside, you know, any sequel stuff. I'm just kind of going on like what we're being shown between this and Return of the Jedi. So kind of my thought is, okay, so how do these factions, you know, are they logically extrapolated? I think that they make sense, at least for this story. And I feel like Tatooine especially is one of those areas where, because we've seen it so much, it is a lot richer in terms of lore and in terms of history and in terms of world building than a lot of other planets. So it is interesting to see, like, okay, we have this town over here, Mos Pelgo that we haven't seen before. What is its relationship to Mos Eisley or Mos Espa or, you know, any of these other places that have been established? So I think that the writing does that really well, but at the same time, you kind of want to see more, and we can't because, you know, it's a finite show. Mando's going to go off elsewhere into the galaxy later. And all that. So we never quite see the resolution of this. But at the same time, it is a really, really fascinating slice of life out on the frontier on Tatooine that they're showing us. And it's really interesting. My kind of feeling is it's like, okay, they win for now. There's peace for now. And I think it's interesting that it's Mando of all people that arranges this peace. But at the same time, what happens without Mando holding everything together? You know, are they going to get back to the separate ways? And unfortunately, I'm kind of a little bit cynical on the idea of things getting better. They may get better in the short term, but I have a feeling that things never 100% improve on Tatooine. It is a desert. There are always people struggling to survive, usually, you know, at the expense of other people. So while, you know, I would like to see something good happen, you know, and we get a short-term good in the ending here, my feeling is probably it's not going to last, but yeah, we'll see.
Okay, go ahead, Dave, what do you think?
I think Steve hit on a lot of the good points as far as, you know, within the show and the fictional world and everything, so I'm going to kind of go in a little bit different direction. Everybody who has listened to this show, you know, for a while and heard me talk and all of us talk is we're pretty much in agreement that we're not the SJW types. We don't, you know, like to promote racial division or things like that. We're live and let live type people. However, I do come at things. I am Native American and I look at it from that perspective as well. You know, history, life, and everything else that's going on. And I think it's really interesting what you were saying about how these different races are being fleshed out and presented. And the Tusken Raiders up until this series, to me, were always just the convenient enemy for various characters to test their mettle against or kill or whatever else. There was some interesting stuff in some of the Knights of the Old Republic games, with Tusken Raiders, but that was few and far between as far as the Star Wars lore as a whole. And suddenly, here are the Tusken Raiders presented as, to me, a stand-in for Native Americans. I very much understood their culture. I understood their raiding culture. It's a culture that I at least partially grew up in as far as learning our history, my history of my tribe and things like that. It was very prevalent in the American Southwest. Then you know, and they've done this with other things as well. They did it with the Jawas to a certain extent, although I'd like to see more because they're still, to me, they're very one-dimensional. I mean, they've added a little bit more to them, but they haven't gotten the chance or haven't taken the opportunity to expand them as much. But going back to the Tusken Raiders, I wish sometimes that I could teach history, you know, because I think that people either get history too far in one direction or the other when the truth of a matter lies somewhere in between. And I think this episode would be a great example of showing what the reality was in the Old West, in the frontier. You had two groups of people with different, both of them with legitimate grievances, legitimate problems, you know, both wanted to survive, both were looking to expand. And those two civilizations were butting against each other and were in conflict because they were rivals for things. And neither one, both sides were bigoted towards the other in certain ways, thinking of the other as an enemy, thinking of the other as an other. And I think that this show, amazingly enough, I don't know if the writers meant to do this or not, illustrates that the Native Americans / Tusken Raiders had legitimate grievances and have a culture and a way of life that was being pushed on by these newcomers, these settlers. Meanwhile, the settlers in Mos Pelgo, the people moving out into the American West, they were also out there trying to survive. They had legitimate needs. They were being raided. They were being had, you know, their industry and stuff attacked by these other people. And so they looked at them as enemies and they had concerns. The truth of what was going on was somewhere in the middle. And Mando, as the neutral arbiter, is able to come in and see that these two sides could work together and try and bridge that gap. Now, would that continue on? I'm with Steve. I'm cynical. I doubt it. I'm sure that someone would break the peace at some point or another. But I think it was a pretty wonderful way to look at history as in a real way instead of the history that we get so often, which is either the settlers were all good wearing the white cowboy hat while the evil Native Americans were off there scalping and killing them, or the opposite is the noble native is just sitting there with a tear going down his face while evil cowboys in black hats who are spitting and hurling racial epithets hunt them down to take their skins and use them, you know, to wallpaper their log cabins. Neither version of that history is true. The truth is somewhere in the middle, and that's what I appreciated here.
Yeah, I'm part Native American as well, and those points are really well taken because I do like to see how they develop, although I don't think that not expecting peace to continue is cynical. I think it's realistic. I think it's a very realistic view of what would happen given the situation, especially when you're not a fully industrialized society by the standard that we know. So, but yeah, okay. All right, now let's move on to Mando's first confrontation. He goes to where the Gamorreans fight, and it's like Fight Club / WWE wrestling all mixed together. He's finding somebody named Gore Koresh, who's a Cyclops, and he's got to try to get to where the other Mandalorians are. But we find out in this confrontation that, of course, Gore Koresh can't be trusted. And Gore Koresh is also voiced by John Leguizamo, if you missed that. Easy to miss, though. And so once again, Mando pulls a Batman, man. He's got the gadgets that get him out of a fight with like 10 assailants. And I love it. And then he strings up Gore and says, I promise you will not die by my hand. So, of course, we knew he was going to say that, at least writers did, because the wording is so very important there. And then he leaves him out there for the wolves or whoever's got the glowing eyes. And that reminded me so much of season one of Arrow. And so part of what I want to throw in here that I'll hear you guys' thoughts is, I really like it when Mando stays closer to the survivalist, do what you have to do kind of thing. I mean, I know he's got his code, but just about every part of the Mandalorian code he ends up breaking anyway. Spoiler alert. But I like it when he's on the edge. I like it when he's dark, when he'll fight dirty if he has to. That's what I like about Batman. That's what I liked about first season Arrow on the CW the most. And that's what I really like here, that he does what he needs to do. He's got the weapons ready and he'll sell out somebody that was trying to sell him out. So what did you think about that first confrontation? Start with Nemesis.
Yeah, I loved it. I think, you know, this is always going to be a point of contention, is would Batman actually do something like that? Some people say he would. He would let someone die. He's not going to save you, you know? And then that's controversial for others. But in this case, I love it. I love the fact that, I agree with you, when Mando is acting like the lone gunfighter from a Western or a Ronin, which are basically the same thing, it's just our version of a Ronin, I think that's when he works the best. He has a set of morals, some sense of honor, but it's a code that is unique to him and others like him. And so he is not above doing violence or backstabbing others when it fits within his own code. And I appreciate that. He is the, for all intents and purposes, best when he's the honorable scoundrel. Another Han Solo type back in when he originally came in. Those types who will shoot first if they need to. And all of you Star Wars fans understand what I'm saying. So.
Yes. Agree. Go ahead, Steve.
Oh, this was a classic cold open. This when you're talking about cold opens, you want to have that scene, which feels like a little story in itself. But sets the tone for the entire season or for the entire episode. And that's what this whole scene did. It showed us, this is who Mando is. You know, Mando is the guy that's going to get down and dirty. You know, he has a code, but, you know, he's also willing to be a bit ruthless when he has to be. And I think the thing to kind of point out about his ruthlessness, and I agree he is that, but he's not just ruthless for himself. He will go to any lengths if it means protecting Baby Yoda. So that means that, you know, he's more than willing to break, like, his own code to do that, which we see later. But particularly here, it's like, I don't care if you live or die. You're not going to touch my – you're not going to touch the little baby over here that I'm protecting, because I gave my word that I would do that. This is part of his code, too. So he's willing to choose between parts of his code if he sees them as being in conflict, and he will choose what he thinks is the ethical, in his point of view – interpretation of that code, if it means protecting, you know, not only, you know, being able to sleep better for himself, but also protecting the kid, because the kid is the most important thing to him at this point in time. And it's great to see that. But yeah, but it's also nice to see him just being a badass, going in there, you know, killing all these guys, you know, using the micro missiles, you know, all these other things that he's got stashed. You know, this whole thing is just it's just a perfect establishment of who Din Djarin is, of who, you know, what his relationship with Baby Yoda is, and basically what the show is about. Just absolutely wonderful scene.
Agree with all that as well. All right. Then we come to his brief meeting with Pelimoto, Amy Sedaris, and we've already established her as Star Wars Ripley. So she's always funny. But I want to move on to the next big confrontation, which is when he gets to Mos Pelgo and he comes face to face with the marshal who has on Mandalorian armor. Now, this was a bit of a, I won't say bait and switch, a bit of a fake out like they did in Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. in the opening scene, everybody on the bridge dies, and then we see it's a simulator, and we see Spock die. And that is what totally sets you up for when he really dies at the end of the movie. And so what they did here by having him show up in Boba Fett's armor was a bit of a turtle game, a bit of a miscue, a bit of a curly shuffle. Whoop, 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 whoop. throw you off from the fact that later on, spoiler alert, the actual Boba Fett was going to be showing up, but we'll get to that in a minute. So my thoughts on the confrontation was, it was the only part of the episode that felt just a little bit cheesy. But again, if we're going to go with the Western vibe, we have to have all the tropes. So because his entrance was kind of, I was kind of laughing. I was like, really, dude, really? But again, that's just, you know, being nitpicky. But the fact that he had the armor, the fact that they didn't like each other, but then they got into his backstory. And they agreed to work together or whatever, because it makes, it's like Steve said, it makes the character, gives it some depth, but it makes sense inside the story. It makes sense given the Empire falling and giving him having some money and him coming up on that armor from the Jawas. But the question remains, where did they get it from? So did they go into the Sarlacc pit and pull it off of what they thought was Boba's corpse? Did they pull him out and separate him from it? The crate dragon lives in an abandoned Sarlacc pit because he ate the Sarlacc. So there's some ideas there that we need to explore as well. But I thought the meeting between them was pretty cool. I must say, I thought it was going to be a little bit more physical than it was. I thought they were going to fight longer. I did not expect them to come to some kind of term so quickly. But then again, that's just a limitation of the episode runtime, because they couldn't stay at odds. But I thought they would. I thought they would be a little bit more antagonistic when Mando goes, give me that armor. You don't deserve to wear that armor. That armor doesn't belong to you, that kind of thing. It harkens back to his original creed and code. And that's why I thought he was going to push that line a little bit more. But like both of you guys were saying, he's more interested in protecting Baby Yoda and kind of going about his business. So he's backed off of being so hardcore about his Mando creed / religion. So tell me what you thought about that confrontation. Start with Steve.
Yeah, I would say I'm largely with you. It was okay. I wouldn't say that it was like an amazing scene or anything like that. But it did what it needed to do. They needed to meet each other, resolve the conflict, and then, you know, move on and towards getting rid of the Krayt Dragon. The one thing I will add is that I kind of feel like the conflict, or at least the fake out, served a purpose, because they needed to establish in this particular episode just what Mando's viewpoint towards the armor is. So we needed to establish that part of his code that, you know, the Mandalorians don't like people who are not Mandalorian using their stuff, you know, because of whatever their code is or whatever their religion is. You know, that needed to be shown. So clearly what I think is going on is this guy is being used as kind of like the butt of the joke, so that later on when Boba actually shows up later, you know, that relationship is already defined, because we know, you know, okay, yeah, he's going to have an issue with Boba wanting to reclaim the armor, because how do we know he's a real Mandalorian, and what makes a Mandalorian, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we need this scene to establish that. So as a bit of long-term storytelling, I think I get where they were coming from with it. It's not like the most elegant scene, but I think it did what it needed to, both in the short term to move the episode along, and in the long term to plant the seeds for what's going on much later on. So, yeah, it worked okay.
All right. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, I think you both hit on most of the points. I would say when I watched this, my first thought in their initial showdown is the only thing missing was the tumbleweed rolling across. I was waiting for that, and I was a little disappointed it didn't happen. I wanted to see the Star Wars version of a tumbleweed. I'm going to disagree with you a little bit as far as Mando's attitude here. I think if there was a weak point in this episode, it was this scene. I think that when he had gotten any lip from this guy with the armor on, that given what we saw, especially in the cold open, like Steve was talking about, that Mando probably would have shot first and asked questions later. And then the fact that it was Beskar armor would give them an opportunity for, you know, he wouldn't be killed. And then they're having this face off, and it could still have been short, but eventually, you know, you could have had an external threat that put their fight on hold. And then the two of them come closer together, having to work together to stop other threats, which ended up being the Krayt Dragon and everything. So I think that it would have been truer to Mando's character, Mando's code of ethics and everything, if he had just decided, if you are going to take that position with me and keep the armor and feel you're entitled to it, then you'll be dead inside that armor. That just felt more like Mandalorian, more Din Djarin. So.
Okay. All right. I can follow that. Okay. We already talked about them brokering that alliance with the Tusken Raiders and the Native American correlation that we've basically seen since the beginning of Star Wars. But this time they're not just depicted as maybe brutes, but they're depicted as someone, a group of people that's fighting for their land. And yes, they are a threat. And yes, they do kill the citizens and the settlers, but they also kind of squatted on their land.
Can I make a point real quick?
Yeah, jump in.
I would just ask everybody who is a fan of the series, look at what this episode did for the Tusken Raiders versus, I believe it's Attack of the Clones, when the Tusken Raiders kidnapped, we are told that they kidnapped Anakin's mother, and then she's just dead. They're depicted as savages in that one. You have no sympathy for them as Anakin comes and just destroys all of them. And I think that the depiction here is just so much better. And it really is night and day for me.
It really is. It rounds them out. It gives them a reason. It gives them an in-story reason for their behavior that makes sense, all things considered. And it gives you great tension between the warring factions because now they have a common enemy. And we get to see the enemy blow right through the middle of this extremely small town. And that leads us to the climax of the episode, where they actually face off against the Krayt Dragon itself. Now, I have to stop here and say, I thought this CGI was fantastic. The only thing that made me scratch my head a little bit was when the dragon pops up at the top of the mountain. I was like, wait, they can move that fast, and they can move that high. So it was like squirming more like a worm if you're going to do that. But again, that's just a nitpick. In terms of the overall presentation of the thing, I thought it was scary. I thought it was, in terms of its size ratio, I thought that was perfect to add to its threat when you see how big it is compared to a humanoid species, how quickly it can gobble something up. It's like a train. If you've ever stood in front of train tracks, the way trains move, they do not look like they're moving as fast as they are. But before you know it, they're on you. Okay, that's the way the Krayt Dragon moved. So when you do things like that and you build in relatively quote-unquote real-world physics into the movement of your creatures, it gives them a depth and a reality, and it doesn't take you out of the scene. And I think that's extremely important because most of the time when we see CGI stuff, it just pushes us out of the scene right away. But not this. I really felt like it was real, like I was there with them. So they're trying to pull it out of the cave. So everybody was yelling at the screen, like, put the bomb closer to the entrance of the cave. But of course, they couldn't do that. So they put it too far away and decided to try to lure this thing out. And given everything I just said, that wasn't the best strategy because you weren't counting on how fast it can move in either direction. So they keep trying to lure it out. And don't make it, because we got to get to that soft underbelly. but either it's too smart to do that or it's too fast, both of which I bought. And then, like I said, the only thing that threw me a little bit was coming out the top of the mountain. I was like, oh, wait a minute, if you can move that fast, you know, it should be a little bit more unbeatable. But anyway, so then I pretty much anticipated the ending, but it was still so cool to see. I knew exactly how he was going to beat the thing. I knew he was going to try to do what Woody Harrelson's character did in Rain of Fire, except he got eaten. But I knew Mando was going to let that thing swallow him and blow it up from inside, because that really was the only way, given the fact that they attacked every other way externally that they knew. So I loved everything about the scene. I loved the cave. I loved the Krayt Dragon's entrance. I've already described how I loved the way it moved. I loved their attempts to try to take it out, but it didn't work for valid in-story reasons. And I love Mando giving Baby Yoda to the Marshal, saying, if I don't make it, see that he gets to his people. So Mando was, once again, being that, you know, renegade, that outlaw, but he was willing to put his life on the line for the child. Like, I'm going to try this, and it might not work. So if I don't come back, be sure that my, you know, mission goes on, which I like that. So I just like the whole thing. I just like the whole ending. I thought it was great. Watched it several times because I enjoyed it that much. That's always the litmus test for me, is repeat playability. Do I want to see it again? And I watched this ending over and over. I loved it. So let me hear your thoughts about all that. Start with Dave.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. One of the things I very much enjoyed is, like you said, the creature. The creature reminded me of a combination of Krayt Dragon Star Wars with the movie Tremors and a sandworm from Dune. And all three of those things are great. Put together, it was absolutely wonderful. I thought the fight was really cool. I think... I'm not going to say it's a complaint, but the only thing that kind of stood out for me is they added some comedic elements with sand people getting crushed or thrown up in the air and stuff like that. It seemed a little, I'm not going to say of a parody, but there were times where you're just looking at these guys running and going, what is going on here? These dudes are just going to get crushed. And of course they did, you know, and you could see that coming. But I mean, that's a nitpicky thing. Overall, I thought the fight was wonderful. I absolutely loved when both of them, the Marshal and Mando, blasted off into the air with their jetpacks and their fire, and they get up on the cliff. To me, the toughness of the Krayt Dragon was really brought home. I mean, we've seen it shrug off blaster fire, but here was Din Djarin's disruptor weapon, his disintegration weapon, and that thing... I mean, the Krayt Dragon was just tanking that. It wasn't doing anything to him either. And, you know, we've seen that thing absolutely just destroy human beings and turn them into nothing. So that was pretty impressive. It legitimately put in my mind a real sense of danger for them, you know, which raised the stakes for the episode as a whole. And even though if I sat and thought about it, I knew that Din Djarin was going to survive, there was a moment when I was immersed enough into the scene that I thought, how are they going to get out of this? Is he going to die? And that is good storytelling. And that is probably the highest compliment I can give, because it sucked me in enough that even though the fan part of me knew that, you know, he's got to survive at least till the end of the season, I'm sitting there watching on the edge of my seat going, oh my God, he might die. How are they going to get out of this? So two thumbs up for me.
Absolutely. Great, Steve.
Yeah, I think you generally both covered everything that needed to be covered. One thing I will kind of point out as far as the fight is concerned, which I really, really enjoyed, is that the only real CGI thing was the Krayt Dragon. Like, everything else seemed like it was done with practical effects, and if it wasn't, you could have fooled me, because they did a really, really good job with this. And I think it's because... you know, they take a lot from the George Lucas school of, you know, do everything as much practical as possible. That's why, you know, Baby Yoda is an actual puppet as opposed to just a CGI thing. So when they actually use the CGI, it's really because that's the best way to make it work. And for a monster like this, yeah, you know, go digital, why not? They managed to make it work, and they managed to make it look believable. So it did look really good. And I love how the threats in this show are things that normally would actually be like maybe a challenge for a small challenge for a Jedi. And meanwhile, you have Mando going up against the same kind of things. And they're and he's almost he's almost getting killed doing this kind of stuff, because the last time that I know of that anybody went up against a Krayt dragon, it took Darth Revan to kill this thing, and Darth Revan is a very, very powerful Sith Lord or Jedi, depending on what period we're talking about. But you know, this kind of a creature that is a challenge for Revan. Mando is like barely surviving against, and he needs an army to actually have any chance of defeating this thing. So you get a sense of the stakes. And because of that, there's a lot more tension. The one thing I will say, you know, is that, yeah, it was very obviously foreshadowed. I mean, there, you know, it follows a predictable structure, but you know what? I don't really care. It looked really good. It was fun to watch. It's great to go through these motions. It was an exciting scene, you know. We really are concerned for these characters, and you know, and everything just works. You know, I'm good with it.
I also like what Nemesis said about them using the jetpacks, because that was a big moment last season, and so now we're seeing him, you know, incorporate that into his attack style, which is very, very important. And again, what we're talking about here that works is the scale of the power levels. That's extremely important in a story world that involves any type of powers or weapons, that you keep the scale and you keep it consistent. If you don't write it that way, all of the threats lose their threat. Like, as soon as they start making Star Destroyers with the same type of destructive power as Death Stars, I mean, wait a minute.
Mm. Yeah.
Just... Yeah. What was the point of ever having a Death Star if you could do that? And when they make Death Stars that can destroy five planets at once. Wait a minute. How did the Empire ever lose if it could do that? See, that's what happens when you throw the power scale off. So far on The Mandalorian, they haven't done that. And it's visceral and it's grounded in the story world. And it's really, really good. So I agree with my co-host that just really no complaints. It's just really, really well done. So the last thing I want to talk about before we wrap this one up is, of course, the big cameo at the end. And the big cameo at the end, the figure that we see is Temuera Morrison, the actor who played Jango Fett in Attack of the Clones. Now, everybody's like, well, it's Boba. And we were like, you know, where is that going to go? And what are they going to do with it? But it was really good to see him. Also really good, again, to tie into the larger universe. But what did you think about that? Is that what you wanted to see? Like, did you want him to come back and get involved along with Mando and all that? Or did you want it to be somebody else? Start with Steve.
I was actually pretty interested in seeing if it was Boba. Because at first, the first time I saw through this, I had actually thought, like, okay, they're bringing back Boba, and he's going to be an antagonist. And that would have been cool. What they did ultimately was fine, too. But I was definitely interested in that. My other thought was, okay, if it's not him, then maybe it's Captain Rex from the Clone Wars and Rebels. And I am a huge, huge fan of Captain Rex. So it would have, either one would have worked perfectly well. I actually want to see Temuera Morrison do Captain Rex somewhere. He said he was up to, you know, doing more roles in Star Wars. So hopefully we will see that. But I would have been fine with either of those. There's certainly any of dozens of other characters he could have been playing, and it would have been fine. But my hope was either that it would be Boba, particularly given the fact that the armor looked like it was Boba's, or that it might have been Rex somehow. But I'm pretty satisfied with the way it turned out. I think most people would have wanted it to be Boba just because he has that like ridiculous popularity, and it's just based on the fact that the character looks cool and he had like a really good debut in Empire. But you know, as you guys have said before, he was really wasted in Return of the Jedi and been kind of a joke. So yeah, I think that there were a lot of possibilities of that scene, and I think that they went fine with it. But there are definitely many ways that they could have established Morrison and made it work, and I would have been happy with a number of them.
Cool. Go ahead, Nemesis. What'd you think?
Yeah, this literally had me jumping out of my chair. I was so excited. I am one of those kids that was gaga for Boba Fett the minute I saw him in Empire, and then was really disappointed with what happened to him in Jedi, as you probably could have could tell. But I've always loved Mandalorians, period. Anytime I could get any scrap of Mandalorian information in the video games or whatever, I ate it up. I've always been attracted to that story and that world and wanted to know more about it. And so this whole series and the Mandalorian stuff we've gotten in other cartoons and stuff is just, you know, gravy for me. And so seeing him there, I agree with Steve. It probably could have been a couple other characters, but I had heard some chatter offline about Boba Fett coming back. And so I was geeking out, honestly. It really was. That's how excited I was. My son had no idea why I was jumping up and down, and I had to explain to him what was going on. And I think I wasn't sure how he was going to be part of this series. You know, as we go and do more of this, we're going to talk about that. Like all of you, I had some questions about how exactly he got out of the Sarlacc pit, although I think my fan logic kind of came up with a solution saying that the Sarlacc is digesting him, and, you know, like snakes spit out the bones of the things they're digesting. Maybe, you know, he got separated from his armor that way, you know, to get to the juicy inner shell. And so as he was being digested, the armor got spit out, and every now and then the Jawas go by there looking to see what's going to get spit up, the next hairball coming out of the Sarlacc, and they collected it. And then eventually Boba fought his way out. So that's my little fan theory for how they got the armor and Boba got out of the Sarlacc. So Sarlacc pit.
Is this strange that I agree with every word of that fan theory? Okay.
Cool. So.
Works me. I don't think I really care, honestly, because his death was like, you know, so unconvincing to me that I don't even care.
It's just one of those things you start to think about. It's like, I don't care either, but I was like, well, how could I explain it if somebody is really going to be a jerk? I was like, well, you know, this happened, that happened. It's one of those things.
Now, the way you describe how you feel about the Mandalorians in terms of the Star Wars universe, I feel that way more so about Vader. In terms of other movie franchises, I always felt that way about Morpheus. I thought Morpheus was the coolest character I'd seen in years, and I hate that they deconstructed him so much that by the time we get to the third movie, he's nothing. He's none alike what we met. And so I like when they leave some mystery and then leave some room to expand, you know, what you know about the character. Always been one of my favorite approaches.
Morpheus had all the mojo in the first Matrix, and by Matrix 3, man, that guy was running on empty.
They didn't copy Grant Morrison enough.
Yeah. All right, we're going to call it there. Is there any other points you guys want to throw out about this episode before we wrap it up?
No, I'm good.
I think we covered most of the basics here. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, audience, remember we want to hear from you guys as well. That's why we give you our Twitter handle. So don't forget to look us up on Twitter. Give us your feedback. What did you think about what we said? What did you think about the episode? We definitely would love to hear from you. Right now we're going to take a little break, and we're going to let you hear some other information from some of our other shows and from our sponsors on United Capes Podcast Network. And we will be back in 5.
From the aisles to the review station, Undercover Capes brings you all things action figure related. Join host Bob O'Mac as he shares his insights and thoughts on the plastic revolution.
We're going to discuss The Mandalorian, Season 2, Episode 2. This one is entitled The Passenger. Just to give you a quick recap, there's not nearly as much layering in this one as it was the kickoff episode. Basically, Mando is railroaded slash tricked slash manipulated into transporting a passenger he's never met before, because she's supposed to have information that's going to help him get Baby Yoda closer to the Jedi. None of it is really worked out. It's all kind of thrust upon him, and he just kind of goes with it. So I guess that's a normal part of his world, because his world is always about wheeling and dealing. Because I don't know if I would have done it. But anyway, he takes the passenger and agrees to take her where she wants to go. But he has to do so without using light speed, because light speed would destroy her cargo. And what she's carrying are her eggs. And she needs to reconnect with her husband so those eggs can be fertilized and they can have the children. And she's a frog-like, frog-style creature. So, of course, Baby Yoda looks at them eggs and said, I'm hungry. And the whole episode has a running gag, literal running gag, of him stuffing these eggs in a mouth that is far too small to actually inhale them like he does. So there's a little bit of Wile E. Coyote physics. But, you know, we'll go with it. And so Mando's taking Frog Lady, and Baby Yoda is literally eating her children on the way. So, okay. And then, so we're dealing with that. But then what happens is we meet a convenient X-Wing patrol. We meet a convenient Hoth-like situation, because Star Wars is only ever deserts or frozen planets. That's all we know. And so they get into the cave. And Yoda, once again, his stomach and his mouth seems to get him in trouble, because this appetite, I guess, is insatiable. Maybe he's a teenager going through a growth spurt. I don't know. But he eats a spider egg. And as he eats a spider egg, he wakes up all of the other spider eggs around it. It looks like a scene from Alien, except the alien, the xenomorph eggs, are about as big as Baby Yoda himself, is about as big as a small child. These eggs actually come in all sizes, excuse me. So there's tiny ones, there's medium-sized ones, there's big ones, and then there's huge ones. And so, of course, he gets hungry, and he crunches a spider, which was nasty, and all the other spiders wake up. And then the mama spider, that's big as an X-Wing, says, not today. And then she comes out and starts chasing him. And so they're really literally having a showdown in what's left of his rust bucket of a ship. And so I'll talk exactly about what happens when we get to the end. But sloppy spoilers, he survives. Okay. So that's generally the idea. My initial thoughts, and we'll go into more detail as we get into the scene breakdowns, but my initial thoughts was, I really thought this was a bit of a bad turn for the Baby Yoda character, and I'll tell you why. I think that they thought it would be funny. I think it would have been funny if the eggs had been plants, but making them her children, her potential children, that she carried outside of her, as opposed to the way humans carry them on the inside. And these literally being her kids, I know you can make the parallel to chickens and how much we eat chicken eggs. I know you can, but I just felt it was a turn they thought that was supposed to be funny that ended up being way darker than I liked. And I know he's a child, but it also made the character seem callous. I didn't like either one of those turns. So just a little, but you know, this is just my opinion, just a little writing tweak to make those eggs be plants of some kind, or I know plants don't have eggs, or maybe bulbs, like you grow onions or sweet potatoes or bananas. And she's trying to get food back to her family, and he keeps stealing the food. Now, I could have bought that. But stealing and eating her potential children and then doing the same thing to the spiders, I'm like, So it kind of changed the way I felt about the child, but not in a good way. That was just me, although I know I'm not the only one that felt that way, but that was really how I felt. I was like, I don't know if that was the way to go, but that was me. In terms of everything else that happened in the episode, it was literally a string of conveniences, because if we don't meet the X-Wing patrol, then they can't show up later. And if we don't, you know, because he was really finished. This is really an episode where he was really finished. Excuse me. The ship was finished. And once again, it's a little bit of Wile E. Coyote physics, because he never should have been able to fly that thing based on the shape that it was in. Never, ever, ever, ever should that thing have been outer space worthy. So we kind of have to look over that too. So overall, this episode, to me, I think they were going for one thing, but it didn't feel that way to me. It felt far more sinister than I think they intended, especially when they get to the scene in the ice cave and the obvious parallels are there, that the frog lady is taking, you know, a bath with her eggs, and she's trying to protect them. And then, you know, the spider eggs are there, and the mama's trying to protect them, and everybody's just trying to protect their children. And you got Mando, who's trying to protect the child, being the antagonist that's eating everybody else's kids. That just did not work for me. Just did not sit well with me. So let me hear some overall initial thoughts. Start with Dave.
All right, I'll get to the egg thing when I finish my idea. First, I wanted to talk about this episode as a whole. On our Discord for Comp Crusaders, which, by the way, go check that out if you're not on already. We have some great conversations there. Johnny Hughes made a point, the machine, and said that his problem with this whole season was, wait, we got something else we want to show you. Wait, we got something else we want to show you. Now, I don't agree with that necessarily, but I understood his point. And his point is, this show is straddling that line between the old version of show, which was episodic, where each week you got the next villain, the next monster of the week or whatever, or the next, you know, situation you're going to be in, and that's resolved, and they're standalone shows. And what we've gotten more recently, which is, you have a story arc that goes through all the shows, and so 8 episodes tells one story. And they're trying to do kind of both, for not only in season 1, but now season 2 as well. And I think that rubs people the wrong way sometimes. And I think this episode is a prime example of the fact that they wanted to do this cool ice spider monster thing on the cave and everything, but how do we tie it in to this whole arc? And so they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. And I think what you get is it feels a little forced. It feels like the frog lady and the whole situation and everything was a way to keep their running story arc, but give you this cool little moment that they wanted to write and show you. And so that's why it feels a little artificial, I think. Now, getting to the eggs, I saw it completely different than you, DT, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but to me, Baby Yoda is like the Force, in that he's a force of nature, and nature is cruel. Nature can be has no feelings. You know, you look at a dog will eat your dog or cat will happen upon a baby bird and will just scoop it up and eat it, or your dog will bring you a half-eaten gopher to your door, not understanding that you're like, what are you doing? That's disgusting, you know, stuff like that. It's just, you know, part of nature. Now, where it gets a little bit confusing for me is that, what exactly is Baby Yoda's intelligence level? Where is he at? If he is a toddler, I completely buy that everything goes into the toddler's mouth and nothing. A toddler never thinks beyond his own needs. He only thinks of, or their own needs. Think of hunger. They think they need to go to the bathroom. They think that they need love. Whatever it is, the whole world is centered around them and they don't think about anything else. They're almost like the truest expression of the natural world. You know, they're all about meeting their basic survival needs and what they need, you know, to keep going. If that is where Grogu or Baby Yoda is at, we don't know the name, sorry. Don't listen to that spoiler, everybody. if that is where he's at, I understand it. If Baby Yoda is operating on a much higher level, then I would have a problem with it. And so I'm going to kind of foreshadow to the next episode. Once I saw that in the next episode, when we talk about it, that a lesson was learned and Yoda learned to think or Baby Yoda learned to think outside of himself, I had even less of a problem with him eating eggs than I did before. So to my mind, I don't know if I'm saying this clearly or if I'm explaining it, he is acting on a food impulse. He is acting as a force of nature, as something that's surviving. He's not even comprehending that what he's doing could possibly affect someone else. All he's thinking about is with his stomach. Not a great thing either way, but understandable from someone who is operating from that toddler survival standpoint, I guess. So does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I follow what you're saying.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, so overall, for the show itself, I thought it was a set piece show. You know, they could have just done away with everything else and just all of a sudden put them in the ship with that passenger and just given me a throwaway line, and it would have been exactly the same because it really had nothing to do with the plot. And I enjoyed the action and everything. There were some good visuals. And I always love to see my daughters run away and going, hell no, we're not watching this. We hate spiders. Giant space ice spiders are even worse. So, Dad, you're on your own. So I was laughing at that a little bit as well. So.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Steve. What'd you think?
Yeah, I'm kind of between the two of you when it comes to Baby Yoda and all that. I kind of leaned a little bit to DT's position when I saw it. I really get the feeling that they were trying to do some kind of a comedy with it, and they're kind of hoping you're not going to think too much about the implications of it. Maybe they didn't think too much. I don't know. Hard to kind of get in their heads with that. But it is definitely one of those things where I was just like, did you have to do that, guys? Did you really have to have Baby Yoda eat eggs? You know, especially when we're talking about ascension species, I can overlook a little bit the spiders if they're not like highly intelligent and they're just reacting, which it seems like they were. I find that a little bit more forgivable. But when you're talking about like a sentient creature's eggs and people and eggs that are going to grow up to be intelligent thinking people, I'm like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't put that in your mouth and swallow. I'm just, yeah, not. It was just one of those things. I was just kind of like, please don't do that. In terms of the rest of the episode, I thought this was absolutely forgettable. I thought that this episode was actually quite boring. And in fact, when the thing originally aired, I kind of stopped watching halfway in the middle and then I went to episode 3. I went back and finally finished it, but it was just one of those things. I just did not care what was going on. Nemesis said, this thing has no connection whatsoever to the larger plot. You could completely ignore this episode and feel like you were missing nothing. And as it turns out, that's what happened. And what's worse is that I actually think that this concept could have had potential. Like if you look at something like Alien, where you deal with a similar dynamic, where you're dealing with Ripley having to be the mother of Newt, trying to protect her child. And then you have the alien queen protecting her children and looking out for her kids. You know, you're having a similar conflict that could have been in play here, but it's never really referred to or done in an interesting way. It's just, how about the Legion of Spiders? And then it's just basically like shooting him up and running away from the spiders and being saved at the last minute. And it's just, Do I feel like I miss anything? No. Is it offensively bad? No. But, you know, it was one of those where I'm kind of glad that the following episodes are so much better. But this one was just one of those things where I just feel like, guys, you can do better than this, and you have done better than this, and you're going to do better than this.
So what you're saying is that my self-image as a heartless utilitarian bastard is absolutely correct, you know?
Not intentionally, but that way.
Oh, now Steve can articulate it for you if you want it that way. He can bring it now. One thing Steve said I want to key in on because it's very, very important, and that is that this is the closest they've come to filler. And most audiences, most fans of a show don't really like the filler episodes unless they give some type of background on a character that we haven't seen before. But if you want to know how you can measure a filler episode to our audience, the way you measure a filler episode is, can you take it out of the season and the season still counts? That answer for this episode is 100% yes. To take this episode out, leave the other seven in, and season still is just fine. That's how you know it's filler. If they wanted to get away from that, they should have made the frog species relevant, more relevant than they were, to the overall arcs that play out in the story. Like, it would have been really interesting if the final scene was that one of the frogs, the man or the woman, had force sensitivity. They moved something with some force power, and they were Jedi, actually helping Mando get closer to his goal. See, now that's interesting, and that's also something we can revisit later. But just the way they wrote it, you can just pop this whole episode out and it doesn't make any difference, just like Steve said. So that's something to consider both as an audience member and as a writer, that if you're doing stuff, if it doesn't give background exposition, another great opportunity was the X-Wing pilots, especially with what happens later in the season. If we're going to get shots of X-Wing pilots and we're going to get that reintroduced, and that is probably one of the strongest visual reminders we have of the classic Star Wars world, then there needs to be more to them than that. This isn't the first time we've seen them. We saw them last season, I know. But it's the first time this year we've seen them. And we need to have a little bit more about what's going on with them than what we saw.
Can I make a point on that real quick as an ex-military person? I understand that we had Porkins in A New Hope, but as a military organization, I just have to say the New Republic is pretty damn lax on their physical fitness standards. That's all I'm going to put out there, because those two X-Wing pilots were a little chunky. I'm just saying, all right? I had to put that out there. So.
Drop and give me 50.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my goodness. You're a little chunky. Okay. So now we're going to specifically go to Mando's first confrontation. They basically do the clothesline trick where they knock him off of his speeder bike, which I thought was bogus, because I think Mando should be smarter than to be taken out by something like that. But anyway, one of the little winks, or possible winks, is the fact that the creature that's fighting him looks and sounds like Leia in disguise from Return of the Jedi. So when Leia first went to rescue Han before she took off her hood to reveal that it was her, she sounded and looked a little bit like that. So maybe it's a wink to that. Maybe that's a different species, or maybe that's a particular set of armor. So it's a Bausch or Bush disguise, Return of the Jedi, but the mask is a little bit different. So I thought that was interesting. So anyway, Mando once again he pulls a Batman, he outthinks him. This is why I love Batman, because Batman can always outthink you. If he cannot fight you, he can always outthink you, because he's always studying you. He studied criminal psychology. He knows what to look for. And so what Mando does is gives him his jetpack in lieu of the guy taking the knife off of the throat of the child. As soon as he did that, I knew what was going to happen. I was like, you idiot. But it was still it was still fun to watch. I was like, yeah, we know how this is going to end. And also, let me throw in here, just as a side note, this is tangential, but it is related. This is what gets on my nerves about Superman's crystal computer in the fortress, because they should be keyed to only work for him. How can anybody and their mama come in the fortress and work his crystal krypton computer crystals? How? They shouldn't respond to anybody but Kal-El. So anyway, just throwing that in there. This is what I mean when I say, when you think it through, it makes all the sense in the world that you can steal a Mandalorian's jetpack if you want to, but you won't be able to work it. And you won't be able to work it better than they can. And they've already got some tricks that you wouldn't know. So that's what I really liked about that scene. So let me hear your thoughts about that first confrontation. Start with Steve.
This was easily the best part of the episode. I'm not going to lie. Like, it was exciting. It was another one of those cold opens where it shows exactly who Mando is. And it's nice to be able to see Mando, you know, not overwhelmed, you know, not getting his butt kicked every 5 minutes. It's nice to see him have that victory and have him earn it. This is the important thing, you know, where some of the times that we've seen, you know, characters, you know, manage to get a win magically out of nowhere and pull it out of plot convenience. This is not plot convenience. This is Mando being prepared. This is Mando being smart and making smart decisions. This is Mando thinking like a guy who is an experienced fighter, an experienced gunslinger, a guy who knows the frontier and how to operate in it. So it was nice to kind of see that scene. And I think it actually, in a way, the fact that the cold open was so good makes the rest of the episode so much more disappointing, because it's like, why isn't the rest of this episode as good as this? So there was that whole thing. I really enjoyed at least this part, but I just really wish it hadn't gone downhill from there.
All right. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, I think both of you really hit on most of the points. What I will say is that this whole series so far, and this episode in particular, what I can say is that the action is top-notch. And the fighting style that they have come up with for Din Djarin is really kind of beautiful to watch on a number of different levels. It's functional, it's utilitarian, it's effective, and it can be brutal at times, and I love it. I mean, I guess that's my cold-hearted bastard coming out, but I absolutely love it. I love the fact that he takes no crap from anyone. He's like, I think your Batman reference is right on. He is the Star Wars Batman at this point. And he thinks about what he's going to do. So his solution, when he's put in a no-win situation, he finds a way to win, which is Batman-esque, which is incredible. And the only thing I will say against Din Djarin is the same thing that has bit Batman in the butt sometimes, is that he is almost too dependent on his suit sometimes, and I'd like to see that in later episodes of what happens when he doesn't have Beskar armor to protect him, because he'll tank rounds on purpose knowing that it won't get through his armor. The same way Batman will sometimes tank bullets and stuff knowing that his Kevlar or his bat, you know, the bat suit will protect him. And sometimes that comes back to bite him. And I'm looking forward to seeing that, because it's just one more aspect of his fighting style. And I have no doubt that he'll adjust. And it's just cool to see him recognize that, hey, I've got this armor on. You can shoot. You're not going to do anything to me. So I'm going to tank it and then come over there and punch you in the face or kill you or whatever I'm going to do. I enjoy it. And so it's really wonderful to watch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also it creates the sense of, what else can he do that we haven't seen yet? Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of interest you want to create with your main protagonist. If you feel like he's exhausted his bag of tricks, and he becomes boring to watch because you already know what he's going to do. Okay, back to Mos Eisley we go. Again with Pelimoto. Card game with an insect named Dr. Mandible. Okay, that's not heavy-handed. Okay, so first Peli tricks Mando into covering the bet. And then they're eating the dragon meat, which I don't know if I would have ate that crate dragon because when I look at what it eats, I'm like, I don't know what's in that meat. But anyway, and then so another hot tip about where Mando can find other Mandalorians. And oh, yeah, this tip won't cost you anything except maybe taking a passenger to her destination, and he can't use Lightspeed. So, again, I thought that was, I don't know, kind of a shaky setup because I wouldn't have done it. If I was banned on that position, I'm like, yeah, no. You know, that's like going into battle. It's like in Aliens when they went into the Hive, but they told them they couldn't shoot their weapons. They couldn't shoot any type of rifle fire, you know, automatic weapons. They could only use flamethrowers. I'm like, why would you go into an alien nest, but you can't use automatic weapons? That's what that felt like to me. Why in the world are you going into space, but you can't use hyperspeed? But anyway, so that felt a little to me. So he accepts. And other things happen. And there's a communication barrier, which I thought was very good in story, that everybody doesn't automatically speak English. I liked how she hooked up the droid to talk to him. I actually really, really liked that. But that, to me, spoke to what Steve talked about in terms of intelligence levels, because they kind of need to be clear so we can see some type of consistent thing. And then, so the next thing that really happens is that he gets in trouble with the X-Wings who are on patrol trying to check his permits, and they get kind of hardcore about it. They don't want to let him pass, you know, without it. Also, Dave Filoni was one of the X-Wing pilots, cameo, if you missed that. And so...
So I called Dave Filoni a little chunky, is that what you said?
No, it was the other guy.
Okay.
So, long story short, that's what ends up having the Razor Crest down on Hoth 2.0. So before we go any further than that, tell me what you thought about the whole setup, about the card game, about the dragon meat roast, about Melly, you know, excuse me, Pelimoto, kind of tricking him into doing this thing. You know, it's like everybody's got a hustle. And I know Mando's used to that, but I don't know. So tell me what you thought about it. Start with Dave.
Yeah, I thought it was just kind of standard fare. I mean, it's your standard Tatooine thing, you know, Mos Espa. Is that what this place? That's a, this place, Mos Espa, right? Where they're at? No, they're I don't know. I don't Mos remember. Eisley. Yeah. It, you know, it's just, the whole planet is a hive of scum and villainy, you know, so even the good people have got a little scum and villainy in them. So, you know, I'll allow it. I'll let it go. I really did dig the fact when the frog lady used the droid as a communications device. I thought that was really, really cool. I thought that was a great little segue in the episode. And then the X-Wings coming along, it's interesting to me. I don't know. You know, I feel like the New Republic is this big, you know, is one of the matzo balls that's hanging out there, and I'm not sure what its role is, especially out here on the Outer Rim. It seems to conveniently show up when they need it to show up, and then it seems to be it absolutely absent when they need it to be absent. So it's like, what is going on? You know, all of a sudden, of all the places in all the galaxy for these two X-Wings to show up, they happen upon this one fighter out in the middle of the vastness of space. But meanwhile, when a whole town is being gobbled up by crate dragons, and New Republic's nowhere to be found. So, you know, what's going on with them out there? So that is a little, you know, like I said, it's one of those things that's hanging out there for me that leaves me some questions. So,
and let me throw in here right quick before I throw it over to Steve. Most people think of the Mos Eisley Cantina as Mos Eisley. But Mos Eisley is a town, and the cantina is just something in the town. All right, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, in terms of all the setup, it just everything just felt so contrived. Like, you can see the plot gears turning, and if you're, like, one with the writer's code, you're just going to see, okay, yeah, this is the setup that forces Mando to agree to this. And, oh, yeah, here's the New Republic, and that's how we end up out here on Hoth, you know, on Hoth Light. basically. And it's just, come on. Come on. I mean, it's not bad. It gets everybody from point A to point B. But the problem is like, you can see the hand that's turning and making everything go from point A to point B. And nothing really feels like it's organic in terms of this is how the characters would act. I just feel like Mando probably would not have accepted this job. I'm not sure he would have needed to take this job to find the person that we find next episode. I think there probably would have been other ways, but you know, this is the way they wanted to do it, and they wanted to have this story happen in the middle of all this, so this is what happens. In terms of the New Republic, I semi-agree with you, Nemesis. The thing is that the New Republic is a very big bureaucracy, and they're probably only able to do certain things or have certain amounts of influence. That having been said, I do feel like them suddenly being here, you know, looking for Mando is a little contrived, unless there's some kind of a ulterior motive behind the X-Wing pilot guy. And I feel like there probably is, but we haven't seen what it is yet, and we probably aren't until season 3. But we do kind of see this guy again, and he does definitely seem to have something that's going on with him. But we're just not seeing like the full picture. But I think a lot of what, you know, them turning their blind eye to great trait dragons and things like that, I can overlook that a little bit just because it's a big New Republic, a bloated government that doesn't have a lot of power really in the Outer Rim. They're just trying to maintain a token presence, and they can't cover all the whole thing. So, you know, they'll overlook certain things and then focus on other things. Now, my question is, why are you focusing on this bounty hunter, you know, running around in the Razor's Crest when you could be doing anything else, including dealing with the Empire? That's kind of where I'm sort of like, what's going on with that? But yeah, it's just this is one of the reasons why I was bored with this episode, because it is just so obviously contrived.
And one of the things I think would be interesting from a New Republic standpoint is, I agree with you, what you said, you know, everything makes sense from being a big bureaucracy and everything. It's like, okay, you got these two X-Wing guys out here responsible for a huge swath of the Outer Rim. It's like, they're far from the central bureaucracy. They're far from the idealism of the New Republic. Have these guys be a little bit on the take, you know? It's like, yeah, you got this problem with your ship if you give us a little bit of this or that. And then it makes it a little seedy, a little more scum and villainy. You know, they get a little bit dirty. And even if you want to bring them back later as characters that are doing stuff, it makes it feel more real in a series that is not afraid to I hate that word deconstruction because it has such a negative connotation. It's not afraid to go into more depth on everything, including Tusken Raiders and everything. Seeing a few X-Wing Republics on the very fringes of the New Republic and the Outer Rim who are willing to take a little bit of, you know, bling-bling cash in order to overlook the fact that you're not registered, that makes perfect sense to me and would have added to the story.
Credits makes the galaxy go round.
Yep. Okay, and that's basically the setup we get and the interaction, again, like I've talked about before, between Baby Yoda and the eggs and the frog lady really communicating, pressing her need to get her family back to safety on Mando. Okay? So finally we crash in the cave and frog lady kind of goes in the pool and kind of chills with her eggs, which wasn't really the smartest move, given that that stuff we talked about before about nature and how nature is, you know, unyielding and caring. You didn't really know what kind of environment you were in, and those eggs mean everything to you. So you take them out of their travel case and put them in the water or whatever. So I get what you're trying to do, but you don't know what's in that cave, so that wasn't the smartest thing. And then Baby Yoda, once again, at this point, I would think Mando would keep a little bit of a tighter rein on him because the kids let his mouth get him in trouble. And like I said in my opening comments, him eating spider eggs makes him look even more sinister. Even though we've seen him swallow frogs whole, I get what this guy is or whatever, but it still seemed just kind of like, well, you kind of deserved them getting mad at you. What you think they was going to do? You're sitting up there eating their kids. Of course your mama's coming after you. So once that happens, a real fight ensues, and it really looks like they're done. There's actually really no way they're not done, because not only are there spiders everywhere, but this is one of the few times where the difference in size and shape makes the attack more deadly. The small ones were scuttling everywhere. The medium-sized ones were pounding on the windshield. And the big one fell right on, I forgot, either the front cab or the top of the Razor Crest. But either way, all of them, regardless of their size and shape configuration, added to the threat. That part I really liked in terms of the writing. I thought that was brilliant. And they really deserved what they got, because the spiders weren't messing with them. Baby Yoda messed with the spiders. So, okay. And so then what happens is basically X-Wing Ex Machina and the pilots show up and just start blowing all the spiders away. There's no way after all that the Razor Crest flies again. I'm sorry. Just no. But, of course, it does. So they just blow them away. And they agree to look the other way, even though he didn't have his papers or whatever, because they helped him bring in some other bad guys in the sector. So that all felt very convenient, and it all felt very circumstantial. And you just tweak any one little thing in that scenario, and the story ends completely differently. And it's basically the end of Mando and Baby Yoda. That's how close this thing came. So give me your thoughts on the ending. Start with Steve.
Yeah, the X-Wing Ex Machina sounds about right. I will say that there is a similar situation that develops at the end of the season, and it actually made a whole lot more sense than what happens here. Because towards the end, at least you can say, okay, this was established, this was set up. So when help comes, you know, we are trained to expect that, because the call was sent out in a previous episode. Here, it just feels like, okay, why are they following Mando? Why are they not, like, giving up looking for him? You know, why are they in such a hurry to find this guy, what, to read him his parking ticket? I mean, what does the New Republic gain, or what do these officers gain, you know, from doing this, other than maybe being a little annoyed that, you know, Mando tried to skip out on him? It just doesn't make any sense at all. And I will say, yeah, the Razor Crest should not have flown. And I think they made a mistake here by not having the X-Wing guys help them. Because at least, you can say, all right, the X-Wing guys may have brought, like, some repair kits, or they may have brought, like, you know, some equipment to help them fix the ship or something. And that would have made some sense. But no, it's like, okay, because of what you did, we're just going to just leave you alone, even though we had no reason to chase you to begin with. And we're just going to kill that monster, because why? I mean, why, if you really don't care about Mando in any way, why are you not letting him fend for himself? None of this really adds up, and it just seems to me like the X-Wing just comes out of nowhere for no reason whatsoever, except because we need somebody to come save Mando, because he's in over his head here. Really was not a fan of that whole thing. It's just not very good resolution at all.
No, it wasn't. So here's what I'm going to throw out. How would you have written the ending? I'll give you a few minutes to think about that, and I'll give you my answer. The way I would have written the ending was, I would have used some of the charges that Mando seen before, or used his little tuning fork stick. Spiders, I know he was outnumbered, but I would have had it, would have used sonic waves. And if he can create sonic waves with it and either destroy them or mess up their equilibrium, because that works naturally against creatures in nature, because sound waves are a real thing. So if he was able to create some type of sonic pulse, he would have had to, of course, put his hand over his own ears, and Baby Yoda's got ears as long as your arm, so that would have been interesting. So he would have had to find a way to seclude them from the wave, but I would have had him release serious sonic pulses that would have either vibrated the spiders apart or messed up their inner ear so bad that they just shut down. But I wouldn't have allowed the Razor Crest to get that damage, because no way that ship is space worthy. So we talked about that. And I also would have, I'm not quite sure how I would have done it. I wouldn't have kept on with the Baby Yoda eating the eggs thing with no retaliation. Now, I don't know if this is my personality or whatever, but I would have had that frog lady slap the teeth out of his mouth. I would have been like, if you don't get your hands off my children, kawooka. And see, now that would have been funny. So my last shot wouldn't have been him stuffing another egg down his too small to swallow that egg throat. It would have been the mama understand what was going on, counting her eggs. That's the biggest plot hole in the whole episode to me. How can you be so concerned with getting your eggs to get fertilized and you don't know, you started out with 12 and now you have 9? How can you take them all out in the pool and you didn't count them and you don't know some of them? That makes no sense to me. So I would have had her slap the teeth out of Baby Yoda's mouth, and that would have been his little instructional for this episode that maybe you don't just grab everything you see and eat it. So that's how I would have written the ending. Sonic Pulse with his large gun that looks like a tuning fork, a sonic cannon that threw off the equilibrium of the spiders, not completely trashed the Razor Crest so it was believable that it could fly, and Frog Lady getting some kind of pushback. Some kind of retaliation, some type of slapback against Baby Yoda eating those children, because the last shot was him stuffing another one down his throat, and it was never funny to me. So that's what I would have done. So let me hear how you would have written the ending. Start with Nemesis.
Yeah, well, I definitely agree with you with the Frog Lady. I would have had her go even further. I would have had her actually at some point find out that the eggs are being eaten and then reacted like an angry mother, you know, which would have been violent, you know. And I think that it would have been good. As far as the ending, I enjoyed the whole scene. I thought the action was wonderful with everything. I would have let the Razor Crest get damaged as well. I had a problem with the X-Wings showing up, but I think you could have fixed that with him sending out like an emergency signal as the ship is getting absolutely destroyed. And then they come back and save them. And then what I would have done is actually have all of them, have Din Djarin arrested and the other two taken into custody. And they call in like a hauler or a shuttle or something that transports the Razor Crest. And the nearest planet happens to be the planet where they're going to for episode 3. And then when they show up at that planet, they find out all the information that they so conveniently had when they were in the ice cave, that he had helped them. And they decide, hey, you know, we'll let bygones be bygones. We're going to waive your fee for not having the transponder and let you go. But, oh, by the way, you owe us money for transporting your wreck of a ship to this planet. And then that's why he has to go on a mission. And then the rest of, you know, to make some money. And then the rest of episode 3 would unfold from there instead of what we got instead. That's how I think I would have worked it.
Okay. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I think Nemesis kind of had a little bit of where I was going with it. I do think that making some kind of a call to the X-Wing guys would have made sense, but I would have had the Frog Lady do it.
Ooh.
Because on the basis that, okay, maybe he's wanted by them, but she's not. She may very well be a citizen of the New Republic, in which case they have to protect her. So it would have made sense if she had, like, reconfigured the robot and then used the robot to make some kind of a call on the signal. Because we've seen that she's a good engineer. Like, that was one of the things. Like, she was the one that reprogrammed the robot and all of that to act like a translator. So we know she's smarter than she looks. So if she had come up with some kind of a solution that would have brought them in, and then it's like, okay, we're going to help you because, you know, okay, we don't care about you, but we do care about this one person who is a New Republic citizen, and we're going to make sure she gets home. That would have been something that would have made some sense. And then maybe have them basically say, okay, but you owe us. Because of what you did, you're going to have to pay it back, and you're going to pay it back by doing a mission for us in the future when we tell you to do it. And then that would be hanging over Mando's head for a while, and then they can call it in later for another episode if you want to do have them call in that marker. So something like that would have been interesting. As far as the Frog Lady, yeah, there needed to be some kind of reprisal in some way for Baby Yoda, or at least some way that he learned his lesson, whether it's Mando giving the lesson to him or the Frog Lady. because it just, the business of him, ha ha, I ate another one of your eggs, ha ha, you didn't notice, ha ha. No, it's not funny, and it's, and it is kind of eh. And on top of that, I agree with you, DT, there is no way this mother would not have known that there were eggs missing. They would have, she would have counted them, you know, by hand if she had to. I don't believe that any mother would have lost track of her eggs. I think she would have known exactly how many there were, and she would have known that they were missing. So, yeah, I don't like any of that.
Absolutely. Again, like I said, that was the biggest plot hole to me of the entire episode. I'm like, well, there's no way. No way this mama doesn't know exactly how many eggs she's carrying, and when she takes them out of the case and doesn't know that they're less in number. I just, anyway.
Mothers always know. You know, I remember coming home as a kid with like a scratch under my shirt from being in a tussle with some other kid. And she had like psychic power. She knew exactly who did it, where it was, everything. I was like, what the hell? So,
mamas, they do know. That's right. All right. Before we wrap this up, anything else you want to throw out, guys? Nemesis, Steve?
I'm just glad that this is like the, well, one of the few episodes that I would consider to be the weakest. And to be honest, like, everything else after this generally gets a lot better than this. So, this is just kind of like a blip in an otherwise really great season. It's just that, unfortunately, it's completely missable. And it's just, something that just is contrived and just doesn't really make sense with how they built the rest of the season. Even when you compare like later episodes to this, and in some respects, even when they use similar techniques, I mean, it's weaker here. But in the end, at least it's not that much of a blip in an otherwise really great season.
I'd say that it's sad to me that this, the good parts of this episode were wasted on an episode that meant virtually nothing.
Yeah.
Because the CGI, the action, the effects, the fight sequencing, all of that was top notch. I mean, as a pure creature feature type thing, it had suspense to it. It had stakes. It was visually appealing. The fight sequences were all great. The way, the different ways that Din Djarin used to kill the spiders, all of that was wonderful, and ultimately it was all wasted on a throwaway episode. And Steve is not being harsh when he says, and I don't know if it's Steve or DT, when you say you could skip this entire episode and not miss anything. So I think it's kind of sad that they wasted all of that effort on an episode that ultimately means nothing to the season at large.
Yeah. Yep. That's it. All right, folks, well, we're going to call it there. Overall, a great season. And like Steve said, it's just really kind of a blip because it definitely gets better from here. So we can't wait to get to those episodes. So we'll be doing two per pod. So we'll be done with this series in the next four. So be sure to download all four so you can hear our complete thoughts. Find us on Twitter. Give us some feedback. Let us hear what you think. I'd like to thank my co-host. Thank you so much, David Nemesis Howard.
Oh, no problem. Always great to be here and talking some sloppy spoilers.
Thank you so much, Steve. Shadewing Sellers.
Yeah, thanks. It's really been fun talking about this show. I absolutely love The Mandalorian. I love the Star Wars in general. And make the Force be with you all.
Awesome. Well, all right, folks. We will see you the next time on the next episode of Sloppy Spoilers.